Coming up on Digital Music Trends 193, recorded on the 23rd of July 2014, Facebook's save function, Spotify to IPO or not to IPO, Ultra versus Michelle Phan and related content ID issues, Senzari's music graph, Samsung's Beatsy headphones, the iTunes Festival, and much more. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Leonelli and this is a weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And DMT is available as an audio and a video show on a variety of channels, including the iTunes Store, most podcatching apps, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, and many, many more. And if you'd like to receive a weekly mail out, please do sign up on bit.ly/DMTlist or head on to the website at digitalmusictrends.com and you'll find all the links there. And this week it's a real pleasure to welcome Ralph Christoph, the co-founder and now head of strategy at the CEO Pop Festival and Convention in Cologne. So hi, Ralph, and thanks for joining us. How's it going?
Hi, good morning. Everything's good. Thank you.
It's great to have you. And it's also a real pleasure to welcome Darren Hemmings, co-founder of digital marketing agency Motive Unknown on motiveunknown.com. So hi, Darren, and thanks for joining me. How's it going this early morning for you?
Yeah, I'm good. It's 9 a.m. This is God. When I said let's do this in the morning, I didn't mean now.
So this week, there's a bunch of stories to talk about. Nothing like massive, but a bunch of really interesting little stories to talk about. And we'll also get a chance to talk about CEO Pop halfway through the show with Ralph as well. So I want to open by chatting about Facebook's new save function. So if you haven't noticed it yet, on the little drop-down menu that appears when you click on the top right hand of a shared link on Facebook, now there's a new save option. So you can save the item into a new tab, essentially, which appears on the left-hand side of your screen on the desktop version or in the More tab on the app. And the interesting thing is that Facebook actually is categorizing automatically these entries. So if you're saving a link that goes into the link section, if you're saving a piece of music from Spotify, say, it goes into the music section, and the same for books, films, TV shows, and events. So it seems to be a really straightforward way to bring the functionality of apps like Pocket or Instapaper into an app that's used by a billion plus people and see how they react to using it. So what kind of impact do you think this will have on people's discovery habits on the music front? And do you think it can have an impact also on the way Facebook targets users as far as advertising is concerned? Darren, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it's potentially interesting. I mean, I do a lot of advertising on Facebook. And I think you are most definitely battling an issue where people don't, at that instant that your ad is served, want to engage with whatever it is you're trying to push, and particularly when that's an off-site destination,
right.
you're wrestling with tearing them away from all the other stuff in the newsfeed to kind of get them to show interest in what you're doing. So I think it's certainly interesting. I mean, part of me kind of rolled my eyes at the fact that they've just, kind of squarely taken on the likes of Pocket and Instapaper. I'd imagine the people at Pocket are a little annoyed.
Yeah.
And they're, and it's that kind of thing where they just seem to keep creeping out and, starting competitor services all over the place, which is normally Google's kind of trick. But no, from an advertising perspective, I think it's interesting. I think what will be the metric to keep an eye on, I guess, from a marketing point of view, is the degree to which people actually go back to that stuff and engage with it. I mean, I think it's interesting because unlike Pocket, they don't cache the articles. So like on Pocket, if I save an article, it saves it into Pocket. And then if I'm on a plane, I can kind of pull it up and read it and all of that. Facebook, my understanding is it doesn't do that. It's literally saving a bookmark, really.
Yeah.
That you can then go.
I mean, otherwise it would have probably created huge issues around people, claiming with Facebook for rights on whatever content was saved.
Yeah. No, exactly. And it would inevitably start a punch up. But justifiably, I would think. But I think it would be interesting, but I'm kind of curious. It's the bit I'm curious about is the degree to which people will actually return to it and click to view the content compared to, because even I get that with Pocket. I've been using Pocket for I don't know how long, 6 or 7 years, when it started as Read It Later. And there's a definite degree to which I'll save stuff And then, you know, I'll forget it's there, or I'll go back and then think, I don't really know why I saved it, so I'll just mark it as read without even reading it and stuff like that. So I suspect there may be a similar kind of thing here, but it will be interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of PDF that I save to my Evernote and I don't actually end up having the time to read. But Ralph...
I can say that about Evernote on the whole for me. I still have a premium account. I don't know why. I never use it.
I save about 500 megs of data a month on it. So, yeah, I use it a lot.
I think what Darren mentioned as his last statement, that you forget about all the things you stored, you know, that probably might be a big issue. I mean, for Facebook, you know,
right.
I mean, because they don't forget, you know, what you have saved and what links you save and stuff. On the first hand side, it looks like a great idea, of course, because your timeline is rushing like nothing else, you know, and especially during daytime when you're doing different things, you just have a short look on Facebook, okay, you just bookmark something. But as Darren said, at the end, it's another tool for Facebook to target you and your habits and your likes and whatever. And that's exactly the point. I mean, it's very clever. And of course, I was wondering why they didn't bring it on earlier, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah. And I mean, the other thing that's interesting is because Facebook is placing itself as in the position of being a platform rather than trying to provide services, and their music strategy is very much being based on integrating other services in different ways as part of the Facebook experience. It would be interesting to see if they could create something like a playlist, BBC Playlister experience, where, you know, you could save a bunch of music to that saved function, and then you may be able to export it into your streaming service of choice, for example, as a playlist. So that might be quite a cool little feature for Facebook to have, although I don't really know how many people would use it, but who knows.
Be like Playlister. Not many. It's like, it's a nice idea in principle, but the adoption is kind of low.
It's going to be probably more interesting for exploring new stuff or stuff you don't listen to normally, right? Like some random video from a band from whatever, 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's my thinking, is would it let people store stuff? I mean, in my experience, directly embedded content where you're pushing a new video from an artist, you're significantly more likely to get engagement with it, specifically because people don't have to leave their experience to enjoy the content. They can just hit play and watch it, which is also why Facebook's directly uploaded video gets infinitely more engagement than a YouTube video, because it's bigger and it tells you how long it is. It gives you all the little signals you need to get a feel of it, to engage with it. I don't know. I mean, go back to your point, Andrea, about the music service side. It feels a little bit niche. I mean, I'm still, you know, waving the flag for Facebook at some point just buying a separate music service and then threading that all through this, because it just feels more and more like Facebook is going to be more of the you know, a sort of central aggregator point for other things. And at the moment, it seems the emphasis is very much on news and what's going on the web. Yeah. I mean, it's almost like a pumped up version of what Digg was many, many moons ago. But you can see that they're sort of pulling in this ecosystem around it of external apps. And I wonder if it seems to me to be more logical that a music service would pop up within that, partly because at the moment, if you look at their acquisitions, it seems like there's something of a gap where a music service would kind of drop right in there. So be interesting to see.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I can just imagine the emails flying around from managers at various corporations that do allow employees to use Facebook, saying, pointing out about this little neat function, saying, oh, you don't actually need to read stuff while you're at work. You can actually save it for later.
That's right.
Read it in your
good
own time when
that.
You get home. Exactly. Yeah. And next, there's a few stories about Spotify this week. So they're all like relatively small in themselves, but they're quite intriguing. I want to actually open with something that came up last night, as Yahoo reports that Fortune Magazine's Brainstorm Tech, Fortune Magazine's Brainstorm Tech Conference in Aspen, Colorado, Spotify CEO Daniel Ek stated that an IPO is not really a focus for the company. You know, he said, the primary thing for us is just growing the business. And he added that, I personally don't understand the quarterly capitalism of Wall Street, and I don't think it's good. So this is a very interesting public statement, you know, considering that the company has been rumored to be well on its way towards an IPO this year. At the same time, the quarterly mentality of Wall Street and that drives U.S. businesses, as we've seen yesterday with the earning calls of Microsoft and Apple, for example, it can really be a burden when your service like Spotify and you're still in a growth phase and investing a lot of money in international expansion and probably losing quite a bit of money as well in the process. So, you know, Ralph, what do you make of this? And do you think that Spotify will still IPO this year? Or is this really like a Daniel Ek putting the brakes on the potential IPO and saying, wait a second, we might do it, but it may actually be next year, to be honest?
Well, actually, this could be a deal breaker. I mean, I'm not a Wall Street guy, but he's completely right. Because, I mean, the growth strategy of Spotify is not about, I mean, the revenue is not parallel growing to the user side, right?
Right.
And I think this could be for an IPO. This is like, I mean, if you have to prove quarterly your growth figures or whatever, I don't know exactly how it works on Wall Street, you know, but this could be like a real problem for them,
yeah.
We can imagine.
And also they have to show that before the IPO, they would actually have to disclose a lot about the company, which is
absolutely
maybe something that they're not willing to do at this stage, depending on how the numbers are looking at the moment. So,
but as you said, it's quite interesting that he's pointing out that on a very you know, public level, right? That it's quite unusual.
Yeah, Darren, what do you make of this statement? And you know, we've all been sort of commenting on stories up to this point with the assumption that that's where the company was heading towards the end of the year. We also, you know, talked about the acquisition of the Echonest as a move towards, you know, Spotify having a broader, you know, solid footprint in the space and being able to justify the IPO. What do you make of it?
I mean, I think it's an interesting one, really, in the sense that, you know, I mean, I think I could be wrong, but I think I work on the assumption that companies floating on stock exchanges or, you know, doing the IPO route need to be turning some kind of a profit along the way, one would hope, or at least thinning losses. And at the moment, I'm not sure Spotify is sort of doing that in a manner that would have investors massively running toward them. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's not the most compelling case compared to quite a lot of other tech companies out there and their revenues particularly, you know. So equally, I everything I hear about Daniel Ek kind of suggests that he is, you know, he's a genuine kind of music fan and he's very invested into his business. And it's not just a kind of grow it, flip it and, you know, fuck off kind of mentality here where he'll build a company, sell it and move on super quick. I don't quite see that. And I'm not entirely sure that, you know, the other shareholders would see it that way either. You know, I think there's a more compelling story that Spotify still has yet to build. And if I was an investor personally, I would probably be thinking now is not the time to be doing this. And the time is further down the line when they're showing a profitability there and they've really dominated the marketplace. Because at the minute, you know, they're kind of dominant in a sense, but in the grand scheme, you know, there's every likelihood that something else could come along and still whip the rug out from under them. So, you know, they're kind of dominant, but they're sort of like the biggest minnow in the pond at the moment, you know, but it wouldn't take long for something much, much bigger to potentially upset that.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's two different approaches. Of course, we've seen Pandora. They've been public for a number of years, and they, of course, have struggled through that, and are still not entirely profitable. But they've managed to, you know, the stock price has managed to rise. You know, of course, in between different downturns, but you know, overall, the stock price is doing well. And so, you know, it's just a case of essentially understanding what the best strategy for the company is. It may even be that Spotify doesn't want to float on the Nasdaq or on the New York Stock Exchange. That they might want to choose a different place to float, given that it's a European company. As well. So yeah, well, it's definitely an interesting story to keep an eye on. And there were actually some reports yesterday that were immediately negated by Recode. And the Wall Street Journal reported that apparently Google at one point had made a bid or was in active negotiations to acquire Spotify for in the region of 4 or 5 billion, I think, as far as the article reported. But Recode actually said that they've done their own investigation and this this was actually not true. So interesting here, a standoff between two big publications that are usually pretty well respected, but it seems like the Wall Street Journal was wrong in this case, apparently. And the other thing was talking about Spotify's Asian expansion. So there was an interesting article by Kayleen Hong from the Next Web, an interview with the head of Asia at Spotify, Sunita Kaur. So in the article, Kaur said that the company is eyeing up a lot more markets in Asia for the next 12 to 18 months and is aware of the need to do more partnerships with hardware and media companies. And also, you know, it needs to organize more events to raise awareness of the brand around the different territories. So, and this is an interesting point that she makes, is the fact that in Europe and in the US, Spotify's growth was really driven for the most part by its users. The company hasn't done a lot of, you know, front page advertising or, you know, any sort of advertising, really, apart from a few campaigns here and there. And, you know, she brings up the fact that in Asia, Spotify's got much less awareness, and so it may actually need to work a lot more on its branding in order to get into more people's hands. So interesting here to see the different approach that Spotify might have to take in the Asian territories. You know, do you see, for example, you know, Japan is, of course, one of the territories that everybody's waiting for Spotify to launch in. Can you see the company being able to sort of flip from this model where it's driven by users to a model where it has to really become front and center and have an advertising strategy and have a growth strategy that doesn't rely on word of mouth quite so much? Darren?
I mean, I think at some point they are going to have to, you know, do the hard work as well.
Yeah,
you know, I think really in real terms at the moment, Spotify has been surprisingly thrifty when it comes to their marketing spends. You know, yeah. When you look at what brands normally throw at their marketing, you know, Spotify's, I would imagine, is a drop in the ocean, and everything about their strategies has sort of screamed that it's very much, I mean, not so much user led, but I think they're certainly, you know, they're backing, you know, promotion via artists and things like that, and they're letting brands get involved, and then the brands are doing the legwork to carry the Spotify brand with it. You know, so Coca-Cola is maybe a good case in point. but yeah, I mean, I think at some point they are going to have to do it. And it's interesting, right? Because, you know, if the argument is that when they get to Asia, they're going to have to spend a lot of money on marketing, then that means, you know, their losses may
become kind of bigger, over,
yeah. Yeah, you know, over a year or two while they're making this kind of aggressive expansion, you know, their losses will really, you know, hike. So I think it's interesting, you know, it kind of dovetails across back to this IPO discussion. You know, maybe they want to get all that kind of thing out of the way first so that when they go for an IPO, they're, you know, very much just established and all they've got to do now is sort of push and grow that bit more, but they've got their feet on the ground in all the territories they need to be in and everything else. But yeah, yeah. I think, you know, Asia has sort of long since proved a really tricky one to crack for most companies. You know, there isn't a streaming service. It sounds like the whole streaming market in Japan particularly is not you know, it's not really established on any level yet.
No,
so it'll be very interesting to see, certainly.
Yeah, and then, you know, it could act as this, you know, savior of industry in Japan. You know, considering that the industry is taking a turn for the worst over there, considering that CD sales are dropping pretty heavily, and there isn't a substitute for CD sales. Downloads haven't really taken off as much. Of course, sales of ringtones have plummeted, and you know, streaming could really wedge in there as being something that can lift the Japanese music industry. But of course, it needs to be something that consumers are willing to take on board and try out. So we'll see what happens on that front.
I mean, I think it may be something where it'll, you know, it may just jump a generation. I mean, it's a bit like the internet access discussion around Africa, you know, where they've sort of bypassed the entire wired infrastructure that we've all grown up around in Europe, you know, and they're just sort of jumping straight to a wireless internet because it's just easier to roll out wireless internet now than it is to roll out wired. And I think it's, you know, it's a similar thing in the Far East where you're talking about the streaming services. You know, downloads, I don't think have ever really cottoned on to quite the same extent, and so it may simply be that they'll just jump straight from physical to streaming, and that entire sort of era of the download model just won't ever really have gained traction.
Ralph, what anything to add on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, we have to face reality. There is not an Asian market, right? We have so many different Asian markets. I mean, Singapore is totally different from China, and Hong Kong is not China, like New York is not US, and Japan is different to Vietnam, etc., etc. I think, I mean, the Spotify model, like, to get a conversion rate of approximately 20% at this point, I mean, therefore you need strong partners, right? But when it comes to China, it's a monopoly market in any ways, right? And if you have to find a deal with, let's say, China Mobile, which is the world largest mobile provider, the world largest player. They have, like, I think, 750 million clients, customers. And two others are just 300 million more, right? So you have to find negotiations with them. And it's so hard to find deals with these people, you know? I mean, we tried to make business once with, like, China Mobile for download stuff. That was a nightmare, you know. Yeah. It's actually not possible, you know. At this point, let's say speaking about China, I don't see any chance for Spotify to enter that market, you know, because you have like already. You don't have Facebook, you don't have Twitter, you don't have Google Plus, and you don't even have you have all different services, you know. There's WeChat, you know, which is like you have like. What's it called? Weibo and stuff, you know, like huge companies and only used in that territory. So Spotify had to find a strategy to work together with these services in the first time.
And of course, let's not forget that in Europe and to some extent in the US as well, a lot of carriers have been burnt by trying to create their own services when it comes to music over the years, which have all to some extent failed. And so that's, I think, why also we're seeing more partnerships being formed between third-party music services and carriers. So whilst in markets like China, I don't think that the carriers have yet had that experience of trying to build a content service and failing at it and then turning to a third party to provide that. So they might still think, you know, we have the scale, we have, you know, 500 million users. Why should we give that business to somebody else if we can create it internally?
But on the other hand, you have like, there's an analysis of mobile users in China. They are all really, really close to brands, you know.
Right.
They follow more likely brands than following artists, you know, which is a weird Chinese thing, you know. So that might be a door opener on that side, you know. But as long as it comes to fine negotiations with the services and the carriers, it's going to be a huge problem.
Yeah.
If I would be Spotify, I would follow the markets which have a sustainable music industry, let's say, so in Asia, which means Singapore, on the one hand, because there's a lot of money, and probably Korea, because they have like a huge scene working on its own, like the K-pop stuff and all the the relationship between brands, stores, shopping, music, and all that stuff. That could be also quite interesting for them.
Yeah.
Japan, I cannot really speak for Japan, but China, I don't see.
Yeah, yeah. And Ralph, actually, I wanted to stick with you for a second and ask you a little bit about what's happening with the CEO Pop, which is it's taking place in the second half of August in Cologne. So a festival and a convention. Can you tell us a little bit about how the event is organized and what you're planning for the convention this year?
Okay, so the CEO Pop Convention is parallel to the CEO Pop Festival, which happens now in the 12th year in Cologne, Germany. We established CEO Pop once back when Popcom, some of the people out there know it still, went to Berlin and then died, more or less. It's not existing anymore. So CEO Pop was like a bottom-up event for the German independent music scene, already focusing on digital issues from the very first moment. So that was always part of the conference. And this year, the two-day conference is focusing on, one day is about branded entertainment, the music brands and branded content, and the second day about content distribution in general. And it's funny to speak about Spotify because we're going to have the German general manager, Stefan Zilch, speaking about Spotify and the new strategy about creating moments, which is like an interesting issue. How to measure the playlists of people and the habits and how to monetize that with brands and corporations. That's going to be his talk about this. And we're going to have a lot of people from the brand industries and the music industry joining together. Broad range from, let's say, Jägermeister to Red Bull, Telecom, Spotify, independent labels, distribution companies.
Awesome. That's great. And of course, if people want to know more about the festival, they can head to c-o-pop.de for more information and to check out the program, which is great. And I look forward to recording a few great interviews during the festival as well. Yeah. So, and Darren, from your end, I want to do this now so that it's sort of a little bit better place than at the end of the show. Anything that you want to chat about? Of course, I'm not going to ask you what LJ plans are for the album release, because I'm sure those are strictly confidential. But as far as anything else that's going on that you want to push, anything that you want to tell us?
There's always too many to mention. You know, we've got the Woman's Hour album out this week. That's a really good record. Yeah, and Secretly great. Canadian. Very, very, very good record. So that's cool. They're playing at Rough Trade tonight, so I'm going to head down there and see what that's about. Beyond that, there's just too many other things going on to mention, really. Weirdly, here's a slightly off topic one. I got given a Nokia 1020 phone by Microsoft. They're sponsoring one of the AIM Awards, and so they've given me this handset, and it's that one with a 42 megapixel camera.
Right.
Have you seen this? So it's kind of got this, like, it's amazing. I'm having so much fun playing with it.
Right.
It's bananas, yeah. I mean, it just allows you to take these 42 megapixel pictures, which you can then kind of, it sort of negates the need to zoom on anything, because you just capture, like, a massive picture at super high res, and then if you want to crop it down to kind of that thing, you're still left with like an 8 megapixel shot that you'd probably get from a standard camera elsewhere. But it's really good. And I love it because it's, I mean, as I said, this is so not music related. But so here's the thing, right? So you got the camera, and then it comes as well, or you can get rather, a kind of holster that you put it in that gives it a slightly beefier thing and a bit of an extra battery so it will last even longer. It kind of makes it feel more like a camera.
Yeah.
But then the whole thing is kind of woven into, I think it's called OneDrive, which is like their equivalent of Google Drive. And it's really cool, because if you take a picture and you've got it set to the I don't care about my bandwidth setting, it will kind of automatically back up even the 42 megapixel shots into the cloud. Now, I'm going on holiday next week, and I now fully intend to take the camera with me because it's really good. There's Wi-Fi wherever I am, and so it kind of means wherever I am, I can just take pictures, knowing safe in the knowledge that it'll immediately back it up to the cloud, and then if someone kind of swiped my, well, Microsoft's phone, I should say, it's not mine, you know, and did all that, it wouldn't be an issue. But careful about
those roaming charges if their Wi-Fi ends up going off and then you end up uploading a 42 megapixel picture on your 3G plan.
I'm boxing clever by not putting a SIM in it, so there is no mobile data. I'm keeping my phone over here, my camera over. But it's just, you have this with Google phones now and again, where they do something and it suddenly makes you realize that someone's really pushed the barrier like a lot further forward. And with this phone, because it's got a whole pro setting where you can pick the ISOs and everything else, it's like a proper, you know, it's kind of got not quite the functions of an SLR. But yeah, I have to say, I'm really impressed. As someone who probably would have rolled his eyes and walked away if someone was like, buy a Nokia phone. No.
I have to say, like, I don't think I would have ever bet on you doing essentially a free commercial for Microsoft and Nokia.
I know, it's weird, right? It's kind of strange.
That's amazing.
I mean, you know, like I said, full disclosure, they did give it to me, but it was kind of like, yeah, I have to say, I mean,
but with no strings attached, so if you thought it was crap, you would have told us.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, more I do work on a policy where, like, if I think something's crap, then I just don't mention it.
Exactly.
Which is telling on my, you know, if you see me on Facebook raving about a band I'm working with, it's because I genuinely like them.
Yeah.
And then if you just don't see me mentioning bands, then it's, you know, then perhaps I'm less keen.
Yes.
But it's the same with this. Yeah. It's quite bizarre. It's sort of like a really good camera. Just happens to be a phone as well.
Nice.
So I thought I'd mention that in aside. I'm not trying to push a Microsoft infomercial on you, so I apologize if it seems that way. But it was more because, you know, like you, I'm a little dismissive of these things. And when you use it and you're like, what do you know?
Cool, yeah.
It doesn't suck. It's actually really good. quite the shock. So, awesome. Fair play to them.
And the next story I want to talk about is the case of Ultra versus Michel Phan. So I got quite into this case, and I was looking at all the different articles and reactions. And so I'll try and lay it out for the listeners that may not be aware of what's going on. So essentially, the dance music label is suing the YouTube celebrity Michel Phan for copyright infringement over the songs that she uses as a background to her videos. So a lot of those songs are Ultra Music songs, and especially they are Cascade tracks. So the label claims to have already identified dozens of infringements, and the case was filed in the U.S. District Court of Los Angeles, and could prove really to be a milestone case for YouTube and for video producers that are uploading videos to YouTube. Essentially, the record label and the publishing house contends that Phan profited from the use of the artist's tracks, and that she had been told that these tracks, of course, were property of the label, but she didn't take down the videos, and she even responded to a DMCA-style takedown by doing a counter takedown to get keep her videos online. So this all kind of comes down to the way that YouTube sets up certain channels, and that's I think something that's going to come under scrutiny, because apparently, and that's something that I've looked into but I wasn't able to verify entirely, Michel Phan's channel appears to be managed through an MCN for monetization, and it's classed as a managed channel, which means that she is essentially able to bypass Content ID, because she is supposed to make sure that all the content that goes through her channel is already appropriately licensed and doesn't require any further licenses to be made public. So in that sense, if that was true, the claim by Ultra actually makes a lot of sense. Of course, whether it's worth $150,000 per infringement, that's a whole other story. But if Ultra was to win, it would really shine a spotlight on how these managed channels work, and how labels can essentially try and find a way to get money out of them if they're not properly paying for the music that's being used. Cascade himself actually is completely against the lawsuit. He said that he actually tweeted Michel Phan saying, "You're awesome. You've turned millions of people onto my music," which ironically I cannot say for my label. So he seems to be pretty against the lawsuit. Although of course, the label owns the rights to the track, so there's not much you can do on that. And I'm really interested in seeing how this pans out, because I think there is a potential here to see the case go for Ultra if the conditions that I talked about earlier are essentially true, and that could actually have repercussions at large on the YouTube ecosystem, I think. Darren, what are your thoughts on this story this claim? It's a very interesting one, I think.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, I think it seems to me to be reasonably cut and dried. I mean, as you said, if this channel is a managed one such that she is responsible for the content that goes onto it and bypasses Content ID, and she does not have any kind of proof that Ultra have consented to this, then she is almost certainly going to lose the case. There's a sort of delicious irony, I suppose, to Cascade standing up to voice support, because obviously, quite recently, he's fairly vocally anti-copyright, which really doesn't make him the guy that you want fighting your corner on this. Because if anything, he's yeah. kind of handing the stick to Ultra Records to beat Michel Phan with, because his voicing support is probably not going to help her case at all.
Yeah,
and at the end of the day, with this kind of thing where you have copyright ownership, pure and simple, it's that cut and dried, that unless she can demonstrate that she has clear consent, then she will be in breach. And if she, if there is proof that DMCA takedowns have been issued and then have been kind of countered and ignored, or that she leveraged the system to get around that, then it doesn't pan out too well for her. So I think, as a case, it doesn't strike me as one that's going to be particularly... Oh, I'm being heckled by my cat. No. It doesn't strike me as one that's going to be particularly controversial. You know what I mean? It's not...
It's not controversial, but at the same time, it really indicates a real problem in the way that the videos are, the upload process for videos of managed channels managed.
And the thing I found most kind of... interesting around this relative to the the broader picture of this is, you know, this is happening at a time when, on the one hand, you know, YouTube is locked in a rather ugly battle with independent rights holders around the contracts for the premium music service,
yeah.
whilst at the same time announcing a day or two ago that they're going to invest further into, you know, emergent content creators on their platform, like Michelle Phan. Yeah. So they kind of, I mean, aside from the fact there's a whole other discussion about the degree to which they're just pulling the rug out from under MCNs, which one could argue here, you know, it certainly puts this interesting position forward where YouTube have come forward saying they're going to back these people to create this content, and now you have a success story from that specific kind of, you know, strategy where she's built a channel and built a personality, a, you know, a brand on there, and is now being found liable of trampling all over copyright, which independent rights holders would say YouTube have been trying to do with all of their content as well. So
right.
It doesn't paint a particularly great picture. And I think, for me, the question is I think Michelle Phan is going to lose this case unless we're all missing something very substantial around this,
yeah.
you know, like the smoking gun kind
unless
of
there's like
paper.
A trail of emails with Ultra that where they yeah, say, oh, okay, know, yeah, go for it or something. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. You know, and unless that's the case, she's going to lose. But then the question is whether Ultra decide to really go to town and broaden this to pick a fight with YouTube as well. And if that's the case, well, then that's when it will really get interesting.
Yeah, and Ralf, of course, in Germany, it's a long time sore point to YouTube, you know, considering all the controversy around it, the game negotiations, never-ending game negotiations, the fact that a lot of labels are getting around the YouTube block by actually categorizing music into you know, music videos into different categories so that it actually bypasses the bans. So what is your take on this case, and how do you see this shaping up for YouTube?
Well, I mean, you know, that at this point we have very hard discussions between the VUT, the Independent Association, and YouTube regarding the up-and-coming streaming idea of YouTube.
Yeah.
And the whole debate to have a fair digital deal, you know, between all the shareholders and what Impala is trying to do with YouTube as well. That's a tough thing, actually, right? Because, I mean, as we know, the indies have a share of 30% of the market, and if you are not Sony, not Universal, it's really hard to speak with one voice and to make a deal with YouTube. At this point, this is the main debate in Germany, so we're going to have that. I mean, they will have a close look on stuff like that as well, of course, you know. As soon as it's touching the copyright things, and in this case, it's the publisher who is just suing YouTube and not the artist, of course.
Yeah.
It's going to be quite interesting what impact this is going to have on the European market as well, which is different to the US, of course, but I would say this at this very particular moment, we have a very, very close eye on that, actually.
Yeah, and I think, like, actually, Gamer might feel vindicated in a sense, given all that's happened in the last couple of months because of its hard stance with
Absolutely.
YouTube. That, in a sense, you know, they were really criticized also from musicians and labels in Germany because of the inability for them to monetize their content. But in this sense, you know, the fact that YouTube has come out with these you know, unfair deals and everything else from the independent sector, maybe Gamer now can actually say, well, we were right from the start.
Let's hope so. I mean, as you know, we have, like, at this during CO Pop, we're going to have a new collecting society going around, C3S, and it might bring some, you know, movement into the into a very conservative structure in a way, you know, that people are depending on the GEMA deals, you know. So I cannot see where it goes to, but it took C3S a long way to go there, but they managed to do it after 2 years. So let's see. I mean, maybe it helps out, especially the indies. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, going from YouTube to talking about hardware, actually, I wanted to quickly have a brief discussion about the new Samsung headphones. So, of course, you know, while Apple decided to buy Beats for $3 billion, Samsung decided to bring out its own version of the high-end fat headphones. And to be fair, you know, Samsung did announce them back in March, or no, April, actually, was. You know, so that was way before the first rumors of the hookup between Apple and Beats started to circulate. So there's actually no direct correlation there. But Samsung has announced that its new high-end headphones line is going to go on sale in the United States. There are four models. levels, starting with a level over headphone, which will cost $350, and will feature Bluetooth connectivity, NFC, active noise cancellation, and hopefully also great sound. And then there are less expensive options like the level on headphones, which are $179.99, which don't include the functionality of the level over, but are quite similar. They just don't have the Wi-Fi, wireless and NFC functions. And then there's the earbuds, which are the level in, which cost $149.99. So pretty expensive earbuds, really, considering. And finally, there's another Bluetooth speaker, which is really quite similar to all other Bluetooth speakers out there, which is called the Level Box. So in this sense, is it just another case of Me Too? And can Samsung in any way compete with Beats' incredibly cunning marketing machine, which has made their headphones really the headphones of choice for athletes and musicians all over the world that really want to show that they're wearing the brand, and that's something they have chosen for a reason. Ralph, any thoughts on that?
Oh, a lot of thoughts. Actually, the whole thing with Beats, actually, for me is, You hear a lot about complaints that the technically a Beats headphone is not state of the art, right?
Right.
It's just a fashionable wearable. Everybody, you mentioned it. It's like in sports, and especially during the World Cup, when the players were forbidden to wear it when the official FIFA cameras were on, and just that brought even more attention to the web and social media stuff. So. It's not about the streaming service. We know that it's about something else. It's about like another hardware gadget you need to bring to the market. And I'm not sure if you should compete with Beats at this point, because it's like they are so ahead in the market when it comes to peer groups and everything. There might be a small niche maybe for high-end headphones when you combine it with, let's say, a streaming service like Wim, for instance.
Yeah.
Which also uses the niche of having super good files instead of like the crappy other files of streaming services in a way. So if you want to have good music, you need good headphones. That might be like a combination which can work out, but that's not a mass market in my opinion.
Yeah. Darren, what do you reckon? If you take a headphone that is similar to the Beats headphone at a similar price point, but you take away the branding association and all that comes with it, what are you left with, and can Samsung work with that?
Well, you're not left with much, let's be frank. I mean, but I don't think that's necessarily the point at which they're looking to compete. I mean, I Beats are very much, rightly or wrongly, I mean, I know the guy that kind of runs the DJ division of the Beats headphones sort of line, the Pro line, and by all accounts, the Pro line of Beats headphones, where they actually focus on the quality, is very, very good, and also incredibly expensive. But generally, Beats has made its name on fashion headphones first and foremost, which is why a lot of people like to jab that, their style over substance. But I think when you look at Samsung generally and its approach across the board, it's been pretty good at trying to bring a degree of style, but also coupling it with a lot more substance. You know, when you look at how they took on the iPhone in the handset market, they just dialed it all up a bit on the sort of functionality front and things like that. And I don't know, I think with the headphones, if they can bring things in that have the style but also bring a bit more to this, like the active noise cancellation, for example, stuff like that, but then bring the price lower so that they can chip into the Beats market, because, that's how they stole a march with their handsets. They were, significantly cheaper than an iPhone at the beginning. I mean, I think probably a bit less so now. But that's what made them a compelling proposition, because they seem to have all the functions of an iPhone, but without the price tag. Now, if the same sort of theory is applied with headphones, where you're saying, well, it's got all of this, but without the cost, then they might well steal a march. Because really, when you look at, like when Google had the Nexus handsets and tablets, and when Motorola had, their handsets, admittedly under Google's kind of ownership, but the whole thing there was very much, let's present a device that is maybe not quite as good as an iPhone, but which is like, £200 off contract. So it's like, a third or more of the price. then it becomes a really compelling proposition. And at the end of the day, you know, people are still a bit led by their wallet. You know, I think there is a fashion element to it, and kids want Beats because that's the current thing. But, you know, peel back 2-3 years and people would have scoffed at the notion of Samsung challenging an iPhone market.
Yeah,
and I think they've done an incredibly good job of that.
Yeah.
They've done it so well that now they're challenging the Android market by threatening to sort of, you know, launch their own OS and all sorts of other things in the shape of this Tizen platform, whatever it is. So I wouldn't rule it out. You know, and they've got a lot of money to chuck at this, like a lot of money. You know, so you know, based on their previous kind of experiences, I think their strategy will be, you know, bring it in, undercut the price on Beats, dial it up on the function so maybe it does a little bit more on whatever level, and then I suspect you might well see a you know, competition there, because they can certainly afford to sponsor the right people to wear these and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, these days when you walk into like a big electronics store, you see your Monster display, you see your Beats display, and you see your Sennheiser display, perhaps, when it comes to sort of more expensive headphones. Mm. And it seems like there's definitely still space for expansion in that area, and everybody's sort of competing on the same functionality and on a similar price points as well.
Yeah, it feels to me that there's a lot of kind of Me Too's ran into this. You know, we've definitely had that whole thing where HMV in the UK was just, you know, festooned with fairly crappy designer, you know, fashion headphones, you know, and everyone's just run into sticker branded product on there, but none of them were trying to appeal on anything other than, you know, the looks, really. So I think having someone that's going to take it a bit more seriously and deliver more quality, and you know, and I wouldn't put it past Samsung to really gun for Beats on that front, you know, and try to make it personal, you know. It'd be interesting to see.
But again, this will cost them shitloads of money, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I live just around the corner here is Saturn, which is like the biggest mega store here in Germany, right? And I mean, Beats is dominating the headphone sections in any kinds, you know, and every other competitor, even they do like extra promotion outside and everything. Nobody cares, you know, just even it's low price headphones, people don't care. Just like, I mean, it's so focused on that fashionable thing of Beats, right? And so
it's true, but you know, they bought Jay-Z, so it's the right people. And you think what with their handsets, during the World Cup, you know, they had Ronaldo, they had Rooney, you know, they had all the A-list players, so they can put a lot of money on it if they really want to go.
And they will.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting space, headphones, and I'm definitely quite interested to see what's going to happen next. And I've seen some interesting advanced functionality headphones that have like touch screens on the side and all sorts of stuff happening that are hackable and have APIs. And so I'm really interested to see how
I love the notion of a touch screen on the side of your headphone.
Well, it's sort of like a touch sensitive screen. So it's like pads, so you can do different things depending on how you move your hand. So interesting things happening, really, and I'd love to see if those reports of Apple being building sensors into headphones to be able to give you biometric data is also going to come true, because that could be quite cool. But I wanted to go from headphones to back to data, as the music startup Sensari has released its web-based graph analytics engine dubbed the musicgraph.ai. So digital music trends listeners will be familiar with Sensari, as they sponsored the show back in March. And GigaOM writes that the new engine is essentially the dashboard and backend system that users can access to get detailed reporting on their accounts with the Music Graph, which is a database that the company claims contains over 1 billion pieces of music data, including song lyrics and the songwriters behind the year's top hits. So you know, the website touts allowing data scientists to execute complex graph analytics and machine learning algorithms at the scale without the need to write a single line of code or software setup. So Sensari has done a lot of work in the sort of machine learning side of things for its music graph system, and definitely at a good time, because we all know that with the Echonest acquisition, there is less scope for companies using the Echonest as their solution, especially if there are competitors to Spotify. Ralph, have you seen what is the program like around the data and discovery at Ceopop, and have you seen an increase in the interest in this area since the Echonest acquisition? How is that setting up in Germany?
I think it's the big issue anyway, the data issue, right? As I mentioned before, with the Spotify in Germany, what they are now working on, or just probably globally, is if you can find out what is the special moment someone wants to listen to a certain kind of music, then you are on the winning side, right? And to get that data, however you can get it, maybe through sensors or whatever, there is new measuring systems. I was at a conference last week in Berlin at Tech Open Air, where people from the Fraunhofer Institute, they just like measuring brain data. There is new touch, whatever. It's like everything is already there, you know. Just like it's just a question of how to combine it with existing databases. And yeah. So this is going to be. It will be the major issue in the next couple of years, I think. And I just bumped into this Zanzari thing. I haven't heard before that.
And actually, a lot of the machine learning stuff was created by, I think the name is Hans Christopher Booth or something along those lines, who is the CEO of Arago, which is actually a company based in Germany, I believe, does a lot of work on data. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's a very interesting tie-up, and he was very keen on highlighting, when I interviewed him back in March, that he sort of wants to get rid of the assumptions that a lot of recommendation services make around the music when they deliver the recommendations, and he wanted to get back to more pure sort of a machine learning based delivery of that recommendation data. Darren, was it 2 or 3 weeks ago? Duncan Gear was mentioning that he believes that it's going to take a while for any company to catch up to the Iconess because they've done so much work in the space. How do you feel about that? Do you agree with him? What kind of a chance these new entrants in the space have to compete with the Iconess offering?
I think they've got a chance, but it requires the buy-in of a sort of significant number of, you know, services to provide the data, because at the end of the day, it's the data that feeds that insight, and so right. They need that kind of buy-in. I mean, from what I read of Zanzari, you know, this proposition was very much of a B2B one.
Yeah.
Which I found a bit curious, really. I think that, I mean, B2B propositions like this, I just kind of read that and thought, well, that feels like you're then aiming at an extremely narrow market, because how many, surely only music serves it. Well, there's maybe an argument that you could say that brands would want to know this kind of thing, that it might inform decisions around music supervision, for example.
Yeah.
So there's a possibility there. But music services themselves, and particularly when you rule out Spotify as the sort of dominant streaming platform, yeah, it felt like, you know, there's very sort of few people that they could be talking to.
Yeah.
Really, you know. So I found that side of it a bit curious. It will be interesting to see. I mean, I think, you know, I do agree with Duncan, it will take a while for people to build up that kind of insight that the Echo Nest has. But it's not impossible, and it will just take the right effort. And I think there's a need for it now that the Echo Nest is sort of off the market, if you like, because they're Spotify's.
The other thing to say is that, of course, if they have built a comprehensive platform around machine learning and content and databases, you know, this could be potentially replicable in other fields. So it may well be that music is sort of a starting point to get some traction and, you know, test the waters and understand how everything works. And then you could potentially extend this to different areas like movies or books or anything like that. So definitely worth keeping an eye on something that is so data-driven as opposed to other discover companies that are more focused on curation, because they are limited to that vertical.
It's a big leap of faith, isn't it? I mean, it, with all of this, it feels the starting point for all of these discussions is a sort of assumption that big data has value and that what it delivers back is absolutely the correct insight. And I think that's still a reasonably well-debated topic. You know, I think I've certainly read a few articles that seem to suggest that we haven't really gained a great deal from this sort of epic quantity of data that's being collected generally around the world. You know, it's not provided the grand insight that perhaps people thought it would.
Yeah.
So I think that it's certainly, you know, you have to step back a little and look at this and sort of say, well, fine, so this is a machine learning service, you know, for, or it's based upon machine learning for insight. But does that mean that the insight it churns out is valuable and correct? Well,
yeah.
Obviously, Sinzari would say yes, and doubtless they've, you know, they've got significantly more insight and expertise on this area than me. But, you know, I think we're still not there, are we? Even Echo Nest is, you know, it talks a great talk, but it's not the kind of be-all and end-all of recommendation systems, and I'm not sure that one may ever really exist, because there's such a kind of illogical, non-sequential, nebulous, random way in which humans connect with and interact with music generally, that, you know, formulating it around any platform that tries to connect dots to draw conclusions is to fundamentally misunderstand that we don't work like that. You don't go from A to B to C. You're just all over the damn place, you know, and trying to replicate that model is extremely hard. You know, the Echo Nest have done a reasonable job, but I don't think they've done a definitive job, and it's, the question is whether Sinzari could do the same or match it or beat it. I don't know.
And it's also the question of whether any company really wants the definitive job. I mean, I think any company that works in this space has to acknowledge that there's going to have to be a sort of a balancing of human curation and computer-generated data. So, I mean, I would imagine even Sinzari, you know, I don't know if they would propose their service as the be-all and end-all solution for a music service, or, you know, or if they would actually recommend to mix it up with some playlisting and stuff like that. So definitely something that it would be interesting to discuss with them. And finally, I wanted to talk about the iTunes Festival to close the show. So they announced the gearing up for another edition at the London Roundhouse, which is going to be just around the corner from where I'm speaking right now. And iTunes will bring some of the world's biggest acts once again on stage for a 30-day musical extravaganza that will be streamed live on iOS devices, but also will be accessible offline via the apps and via the Apple TV for a limited time. And acts confirmed so far are Maroon 5, Pharrell Williams, Beck, Sam Smith, Blondie, Kylie, David Guetta, 5 Seconds of Summer, Calvin Harris, and Chrissy Hynde. So definitely a need for a few more rock acts to join the fold. And Darren, I won't ask you if Alt-J are doing it, but with the album dropping on the 22nd of September, it would make a lot of sense. You know, the schedule, of course, continues to evolve until the last minute, and I really hope a few more rock and events are going to join the fold, because it's a very pop lineup at the moment. And you know, I just want to ask you guys, you know, if you have consumed iTunes Festival content in the past years, and what did you think of it? Because it's an amazing festival. It's really well put together. The videos look great, but there seems to be an element of engagement that is still missing from it, at least from what I experienced in the past sort of 3 or 4 years here in London, but also from the South by Southwest experience. Do you have any thoughts on that, either of you?
I mean, my thoughts on the, I mean, it's funny this year, but you know, you kind of alluded to similar, where I must admit I saw that initial round of announcements and was a little underwhelmed, if I'm honest. It felt a little bit obvious, a little bit flat. There's just, I don't know, you know, I didn't really find myself looking at it and thinking, wow, that, you know, there's a lot of exciting things on there. It just seemed like kind of a bunch of obvious candidates.
I mean,
really.
I can point out that that's usually the case, because like last year, both Lady Gaga and Katy Perry, for example, were announced at the very last second. So it may be that stuff comes out.
You never know. They might pull something out of the hat. Not maybe old Jay. Who knows? I live in hope. But no, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because I think the iTunes Festival is kind of an odd sort of point at which iTunes exposed just how, you know, not very modern they are. You know, I mean, I read a great piece this morning just kind of saying the iTunes app is just so, like, we're totally over this, you know, and the notion that you have to sync your damn phone with it, and everything about it is just kind of clunky now. It's aged very badly. And so things wedded to that experience by default also tend to run a risk of having a similar whiff about them.
Yeah.
And I think the iTunes Festival, to some extent, is like that. I don't know. I mean, you know, they do a good job in the sense that they very much, you know, populate it through Apple properties. So you get the app that you can watch, provided you have an Apple TV and things like that. But I don't know. There's just something about it that feels just less kind of out there than some other things. It doesn't feel very edgy. It feels very safe and just maybe a little bit old, I can't quite put my finger on it, but for me,
where is the conversation happening around it? I mean,
yeah, it doesn't generate anything outside of, like, if you're in Apple's world, then I guess it's a nice free bonus because you own the devices on which to watch it and things like that. But then if you're in Apple's world, you're kind of an Apple consumer anyway. And it just seems to draw a line between kind of, it's all for the Apple customers and everyone else gets kind of locked out. But it doesn't really make you want to buy into the Apple ecosystem either, in my view. It's just something happening over there for those people. And of late, you know, I think, yeah, it feels very much to me like the tide is kind of turning on Apple, you know, their hardware is still good, but I think around music generally, there is a palpable sort of sense of desperation around what they're doing, and trying to, you know, you can feel that the dominance is slipping. And I think, you know, there's probably not a small amount of kind of schadenfreude going on where people are looking at it thinking, this is quite good to see the dominant one slip, because for too long, you know, maybe Apple were dictating terms around things and leveraging the business way, which, you know, we can all criticize, but that's the way business is, you know, and if you are the dominant player, you can dictate terms, that's fine. But now that's less the case. I don't know. It's just, it's that thing, isn't it, where someone's just starting to go, don't they look at, you know, it's all looking a little bit long in the tooth. It's not very sexy.
Well, I mean, for me, it's still sexy, like, for the most part. I just feel like the format of the iTunes Festival itself, I mean, I love my Apple products, and, you know, for me, the appeal is still there, to be honest. I've used an Android system quite a bit. My mum bought one, and I have to keep explaining her how to use it. And it does feel, even like the Nexus 5, feels a lot clunkier and harder to explain than an iOS device would. So in that sense, I still feel like, you know, and some of the market share numbers from the US are seeing it climb up, actually prove the fact that it's still a device with a lot of appeal. But on the iTunes Festival front, it just feels like they've established the format, and they're really sticking to it in a very specific way, and they're not really experimenting too much with it, which is something that I think they, you know, they have the room to do. They have the wiggle room to do whatever they want because it's their own festival. So I would like to see a bit more fun stuff happening around it, maybe extra content, stuff happening backstage, interviews with the artist. You know, it's all about the extra bits now. And the iTunes Festival is very much focused on giving you access to the concert, and that's it. You don't see anything around how it's organized, or, you know, the act sound checking or anything around that, which I think would really drive engagement on across platforms. And also perhaps even, like, you know, iTunes opening up a few tidbits of that content to go onto different platforms as well, and see how that propagates online too. Ralph, what are your thoughts? You know, in Germany, of course, iTunes is pretty strong. Do people watch content from the iTunes Festival, and how did you react to it in the last few years?
I don't know exactly the numbers, but for me, there's like a contradiction or like a discrepancy between iTunes and the term of a festival in a way. I don't think that people, me personally, I'm not using it because I'm not using iPhones. So, but as far as I know, and as far as I can see, the festival user experience, you know, Apple as a platform cannot provide what people expect to get from a festival.
Right.
As you said, it's just the access, and that's not enough these days, because you have compete with all these super extra customized festival experiences around you. I think, I saw it at South by Southwest, right? The big bus, you know, just how to get there and get in and just blah, blah, blah. But to be honest, I don't think it's the future.
Right. Unless they manage to shake it up somehow. And that was the last story, the big story of the week. I can just run through a couple of things. You know, I would invite people to go and check out a new app called Hooked. The New York Times reported on it this week, which allows you to create musical selfies. And they've licensed a catalog of about 50 tracks now with the original instrumental recording. And you can record a video of yourself singing along to the track. And if you want access to the full track, you pay a monthly subscription of $3.99 or £2.49 per month. So an interesting thing to look at, although if they have to do individual licensing deals for each track, it's going to take them forever to get a broad catalog, as I've experienced myself. And you know, Baboom has hired Tony Smith, a former director of finance for Sony Music in Australia and New Zealand, and who also worked at BMG and Polygram. So of course the company is trying to legitimize itself in the run up to an investment round and a launch towards the end of the year or early 2015. So we'll see if that works. And finally, I had something else I want to say. Anything else? Oh, and Glenn Peoples wrote a great wrap-up on the sales domination of Frozen in the United States, and the Disney soundtrack has had a 2.15% share of album sales in the U.S., which is nearly four times the second place Beyoncé album, which is at 0.55%, and the album also topped the Billboard 213 times, and you know, it's just been a smash hit. Of course, the movie is the highest grossing animated movie of all times, and so that's definitely helped in that region. But it also shows that people are still willing to buy albums in certain conditions in droves, especially when kids are involved. And that's pretty much all for this week, guys. Thanks so much again for joining me on the show. Again, it's c-o-pop.de for Ralph, and thanks Ralph for your time.
Thanks for having me in your show. Thanks, Andrea.
And for Darren, it is motiveunknown.com, and Darren provides an amazing free service, which is the Daily Digest, which arrives in the afternoon, every afternoon, with a short commentary and a wrap-up of some of the most interesting headlines in digital music and digital marketing. So you can check that out on motiveunknown.com. And thanks, Darren, for your time again.
Good to be here.
It's a great to have you always. And thanks so much for listening to the show. You can find out more on digitalmusictrends.com. And don't forget to go and click through to the link to the one-to-one show. It's a little bit hidden, but it is there. And every week there, I interview an interesting startup or a digital music company or project or anything in that area on a one-to-one basis. And we delve a little bit deeper into what they're doing. Thanks so much for listening. Have a fantastic week. And until next time.